Okay. Hello again. We're working on our course in the Synoptic Gospels. We've looked so far at the historical Jesus, at the Jewish background, at introduction to exegesis and exegeting narrative genre, at the authorship date characteristics of the Gospels, at exegeting parables, at the Gospels as literary works, and most recently at the Synoptic Problem. This session we want to take a look at the geography of Palestine, including the geography of Jerusalem. So, let's jump in and have a look at that. In order to have a good overview of what's going on in the Bible, whether it be in the New Testament or the Old Testament, and in the Gospels in particular, it's desirable to have a handle on the relevant geography. For the Synoptic Gospels, this is that of Israel at New Testament times. I want to look first of all at the physical features of Palestine, and on a large scale, there has really been little change in the basic geography since New Testament times. So, as it stands now, is basically how it was then. We want to first kind of survey the major regions of the territory from east to west, and then we'll look at the more minor features going from north to south. So, the reason we look at the major regions from west to east is that the major geographical structures take the form of bands running north and south. And so we will list these here, starting at the west or the Mediterranean coast and moving eastward to the desert. The direction of prevailing winds is also from west to east. And since on the west we have the Mediterranean Sea, these winds carry moisture from the Mediterranean and then begin to deposit it as they come inland as the ground rises also and causes the air to rise and the air then to become saturated and drop its moisture. So this will help us understand the climate of each region as well. The first region running along the coast is the coastal plain, and sometimes called the Plain of Sharon. That's not the whole of the coastal plain, but that's a good bit of it. This is a very low, rather flat plain, which is fertile where it's not too sandy or too salty. From a military perspective, this area was easy to travel on so long as you didn't get too close to the water where the where chariots or horses would tend to get slowed up by the sand. And so this area was easy to invade from outside country. The large-scale geography around Israel is Egypt to the south, and Egypt for the period of the Old Testament was a major political power. By the time we reach New Testament times, it had been under foreign domination for many centuries. Then the coast there, because of the rainfall, was fairly fertile, and that runs upward and then turns over into the Tigris-Euphrates Valley and comes down this way. So we've got a shape that, although not exactly crescent shape, was called a fertile crescent. And typically the big military powers in the Old Testament period had been out on the other part of the fertile crescent, had been Assyria, Babylonia, and Persia. And then after Alexander's death, a Seleucid piece of Alexander's empire was also there as well. So invasion would often take place, and the invasion could come rather easily in on the coastal plain, either from Egypt in the south or Syria in the north. Going in then a little further from the west coast, we come to a series again, a north-south region, more or less, that is somewhat higher, somewhat more rolling terrain though it's still pretty low relative to what we're going to call the Central Hill Country here, which will be our next item. With these rolling hills and wide valleys, most of the travel was along the valleys, and this area was still relatively easy to invade. It was also fertile and got decent amount of moisture as well. The kind of central region of Israel, Palestine, etc., is what's called the Hill Country. And this is a region of rather sharp hills and V-shaped valleys. If you're from the United States, this is perhaps rather like West Virginia in the eastern U.S., although its climate would be more like, say, Southern California, what we call a Mediterranean climate. Here, because the valleys are very sharp-bottomed, and because they've got rock in them and usually intermittent stream of some sort in them, a travel does not typically take place along the valleys, but rather up along the ridges. No particular thing interfering with travel in the coastal plain, except perhaps where you crossed a stream coming down to the Mediterranean Sea, and therefore might get some swampy land. The lowlands, or the, I don't think I gave you the name before, Shvelah, was more rolling, and you could travel on either kind of territory. But here in the Hill Country, you really needed to, at least for vehicular traffic, travel at all, need to travel up on the ridges, and even for foot travel, that was the better way to go. This is therefore more difficult to invade. The invaders had to go uphill to get into the area, and did not find it easy to use chariots, which were the, what should we say, the equivalent of tanks, I suppose, in ancient warfare. Farmers did not find this area nearly so nice for farming, and yet because of the way the material was structured, it was basically a limestone. There was a tendency for it to form terraces as you go up the strata were basically horizontal, and so at the edge of a hill you would have a little piece stick out, a little piece stick out, and basically the farmers manipulated this by putting rocks along the outside edge and letting soil build up, or perhaps even helping soil build up along these. Not great terrain for growing grains, but they did grow grains in it, but pretty good for growing olives and grapes and things of that sort. And on the west side of this hill country, where you had the moist air coming in from the Mediterranean and flowing up the hill, you had good moisture, good rainfall. So rather nice there. Unfortunately, when you reach the ridge then, the air having come up off the Mediterranean and having dumped a certain amount of its moisture, typically as it goes up the ridge, you now come over the ridge and the air begins to fall. And falling air warms up, and that means that the relative humidity goes down quite substantially, and so it's not likely to rain. Typically you get what's called on the east side of a ridge like that, you get what's called a rain shadow. In the United States, that phenomenon typically shows up in the Rockies, where you get pretty good rainfall to the west, coming and with prevailing winds from the west, as we have as here in Israel. All that's from being in the temperate zones, where the prevailing wind is out of the west. When you get over the edge of the Rockies and start to drop down, you get the same thing, a warming air, drying air, and so typically rather poor rainfall east of the Rockies, which would be the valleys up there, say around the Great Salt Lake, would be a nice example of that whole area that's a very dry area. Well, that's the same situation you get here. So the rainfall is good in Israel west of the main ridge, but poor to the east of the main ridge. Then coming down off the hill country, we reach a north-south region, which we call the Rift Valley. And you might have heard of that name in terms of missionaries in Africa or something, because there's an important rift valley in Kenya as well. It's actually part of the same rift system. The rift we're talking about here in Israel runs from up in Lebanon, down through the middle of Lebanon, runs through the Sea of Galilee, runs down along parallel to the Jordan River. Actually, the Jordan River runs in the Rift Valley, runs down past the Dead Sea, and then down to the Gulf of Aqaba and the Red Sea there below it. And that's not the Red Sea. That's the, anyway, Gulf of Aqaba, and then runs on down and runs into Africa. So it is a geologic rift due to two plates on the continental plate system that's been discovered and worked out in the last now 60 years, approximately since the 50s. And in this particular case, this actually is a rather deep fault, and at the Dead Sea, the surface of the Dead Sea is actually over 1,000 feet below sea level. Surface of the Sea of Galilee is about 600 feet below sea level. And this air that has been coming from the west has come over the rift, over the hill country, and come down to that. So you get very little rain in here. But you do have this river that rising from the north, which we'll talk about, the mountains up there, will help water the area. The climate down here is typically very hot and very arid away from the river. So in modern times, it's been irrigated to have crops, and at least some sort of irrigation was going on in some places in ancient times as well. Well, we keep moving east, and we have one more territory to think of. We have the Mediterranean, we have the coastal plain, we have the Shfelar, or low rolling hills, we have the hill country, we have the Rift Valley, and then you come back out of the Rift Valley and you come up onto what we call the Transjordan Plateau. And it turns out that the Transjordan Plateau is actually higher than the hill country, so that the air coming back up again is a cool off and actually squeezed and dumps a little bit more, almost all the rest of the moisture that it had in it, which it wasn't dumping east of the ridge, because the humidity of the air was too low. Now the humidity comes back up, it does dump the rest of it, but within a few miles after you get up on the Transjordan Plateau, that's all gone, and you're out into what would be kind of the northern part of the Arabian Desert, or the Syrian Desert there as well. So pretty well watered at the west edge, but very deserty as you get a few miles in east of that. So that's a quick tour of the territories running north and south, and we're coming in from the west. So the Mediterranean, the coastal plain, the rolling country, the Shfelah, the hill country, the valley, the Rift Valley, and then the Transjordan Plateau. Now there's some smaller features that it's convenient here to look at going from north to south. And so if we go up north of Israel, we come fairly quickly just to the east of the Rift Valley to the highest peak in the Palestine area, up over 9,000 feet above sea level, and that's Mount Hermon. It's the southernmost large peak in what's called the Anti-Lebanon Range. The Rift Valley, as I say, runs up out of Israel into Lebanon, and you have mountains to the west side of the valley that are called the Lebanon Range, and mountains to the east side called the Anti-Lebanon Range. The top of Mount Hermon is generally snow-covered all year, and if you're up in Galilee in clear weather, you can usually see a little bit of that. Coming south from that, we come to the area around the Sea of Galilee, which is called Galilee, the circle of territory or something of that sort. This hilly region is kind of, in some sense, an extension of the hill country down in Israel itself, except there's a thing that separates there. So it has some of the features of the hill country down in Judea, such around Jerusalem. But this is the best watered area in Palestine. Not only do we have the situation where the water coming in from the moist air coming in from the Mediterranean dumps its moisture on the hills as you come in eastward from the Mediterranean, but you also have a latitude effect going on here, that we're getting near the bottom end of the temperate zone, and so as you go down south, you get into an area where there's rather low rainfall. But up in Galilee, we have pretty substantial rainfall. This is about equal in rainfall to the eastern United States. So in the 40 to 50 inches per year rain, you can convert that to metric system if you'd like. It's higher in the north and lower in the south, so we've got upper Galilee and lower Galilee. The climate is reasonably cool in the mountainous part, but as you drop down to the Sea of Galilee, you're well below sea level, and it's pretty warm there. We mentioned also Mount Tabor in this area. It's an isolated peak, and it's south of the Sea of Galilee. It's over 1,900 feet above sea level. Contrast that with Mount Hermon at 9,000 feet above sea level. So one's a little under 2,000, the other one's 9,000. And it's just north of this next territory we'll mention, which is the Jezreel Valley. As we're thinking about coming from the north, Mount Hermon here, the upper and lower Galilee here, and then we have something coming across here this way, I guess it is Jezreel Valley, and also called sometimes the Plain of Esdraelon. That's more or less an east-west valley. It actually runs from northeast to southwest, but more east-west than north-south. It connects the coast with the Jordan Valley. It separates Samaria to the south from Galilee in the north, and it actually forms the easiest transportation corridor to get from the Mediterranean Sea to the Rift Valley. Above it, you have to go across the Galilee with all their hills, and below it, you have to go across the hill country. So, but if you go right through this Jezreel Valley, the terrain is actually fairly low. So as a result, an important trade route crossed from the coast over into the interior at this particular point. The south edge of the Jezreel Valley is marked by Mount Carmel and then a range continuing east from that. A long ridge, again, approximately east-west, rather as the Jezreel Valley is, south side of the Jezreel Valley, with a maximum height of about 1,800 feet. So again, much, much lower than Mount Hermon, but actually getting up around the same height as Mount Tabor is. This range forms a barrier to north-south travel, and a person traveling northward from, say, Egypt comes up the coastal plain, but when you get near this Mount Carmel, you've either got to go all the way over to the coast and kind of work your way around the end of Mount Carmel, which actually sticks out in the Mediterranean there, or you have to come back in a ways and go through one of two or three of the passes. Control of the passes was important in ancient times militarily. Remember that at the time of New Testament we're thinking about here, Israel is not an independent state, and Rome, in fact, controls everything on the east end of the Mediterranean until you get in to the Parthian Empire, so they're not so worried about it then. But in Old Testament times, the control of the passes was important militarily. The city of Megiddo is on one of these passes, and Revelation's Armageddon is actually a modification of Har-Megiddo, Hill of Megiddo, and controls one such pass. The plains north of Megiddo were, in fact, a site of many major battles over the course of military history. jumping south now across the areas where Samaria and Jerusalem and that sort of thing would be, we come to the wilderness of Judea. This is a Badlands area. It's actually in the, what should we say, it's in the western side of the Jordan River, and so in the Rift Valley, more or less. It's actually in the rain shadow, I suppose, of the ridge of the hill country. And I use the term Badlands because it reminds me a great deal of the Badlands of South Dakota. It is hilly, but there's virtually no vegetation on it, not least at the tree level. A little bit of shrubbery and some rain during the grass during the rainy system. Well, this is an area where this combination of low rainfall, you're in the rain shadow of the of this ridge running down the hill country, combination of the rain shadow and a poor, rather chalky soil produces a area that is bad enough in regard to vegetation that's virtually uninhabited. So today, and probably through most of its history, it has been an area where nomads come in seasonally and graze their sheep while there's grass growing, and then get out of the area when nothing is going on. So territory used for grazing sheep and for grazing goats in the wetter winter season. One more area we'll mention here, and that is south of the hill country. The hill country eventually comes kind of to an end, somewhat south of Jerusalem. We have an area called the Negev. The King James Version typically translate that the south. don't recall now how some of the other modern versions translate that. It's an arid land south of actually the city of Hebron, which Jerusalem down, you would go down maybe 30, 40 miles to get down to Hebron, Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and then Hebron. territory is flat to rolling. The soil is actually pretty good, but now due to the latitude effect, getting out of the bottom of the north temperate zone, if you like, you are getting very little rainfall. Might for a moment stop and look at the zones, if you like, of our globe. You have the equatorial zone, and then you've got a tropical zones on either side of that, and then you've got the temperate zones on either side of that, and then you get up into a more subarctic type further northern area, and the transition between the temperate zone and the areas down closer to the equator has a rather low rainfall. So Negev area, rolling or flat, pretty good soil, very little rainfall. Even in ancient times, and now in modern times as well, certain inhabitants had figured out a way to actually grow crops there by concentrating water by certain types of tricks. A number of places you would have a valley that would catch rainfall, and the rainfall would then tend to run off rather quickly and deposit, therefore, a soil down in the bottom of the valley, and then the water would run off to the low side of the valley and out of the valley, and they'd basically put a dam in the bottom of the valley, and it would catch water for a little while and would pick up all the silt that had run off. And so you could then grow crops in that silty area. And whereas you might only be getting 2, 3, 4 inches of rain a year, you were getting your little farming plot down in the bottom was concentrating rainfall from a much, much bigger area. Well, that's kind of a quick tour then of the major regions of Israel from the north-south ones running from the coast inward from west-east, and then some of the peculiar individual features running from south to north. Say a word or two about the major bodies of water around Palestine. You have the Mediterranean Sea on the west, and the Israelites of Old Testament period were not really seafarers. but they did work as middlemen to a certain extent of people who were seafarers and who were bringing trade in from the Mediterranean or taking spices and other things out from Arabian areas or such, and so occasionally had engaged in trade in that particular way. Mediterranean Sea, large body of salt water, actually connected to the Atlantic over a way, 1,500 miles further west at Gibraltar. Palestine has few natural ports compared, for instance, with Greece or Phoenicia. And and Phoenicia was on the coast of the east coast of the Mediterranean further north. So the Jews were involved in trade only as middlemen. Then the bodies of water kind of actually in Israel. You had the Sea of Galilee or the Lake of Tiberias or Kinneret, various names given to it. A little lake that was perhaps 7 by 14 miles, something like that. Freshwater lake, surface is 600 feet below sea level, so lower even than Death Valley in the United States. Fed by the Jordan River, which basically its waters came out from Mount Hermon area. And then they still consider it the Jordan River when it runs out the other side of the Sea of Galilee and continues on down in the Rift Valley. The Sea of Galilee was important for fishing, both back then and even now, but its peculiar topography and climate was such as to produce some fierce storms. You're talking about a lake that's a few miles across, so it's big enough that you can get some substantial waves on it, not like the Mediterranean or anything. It's got a hot desert east of it. It's got Mount Hermon at 9,000 feet northeast of it. It's got this Rift Valley that runs north and south of it. It's got higher terrain to the west of it, and it's got the Mediterranean Sea west of that. So you've got weather systems coming in from the Mediterranean. You've got an area up here where cold air can be produced around the mountain. You've got the hot air over here, and frequently the combination of those produced some very fierce storms that arose in a very short period of time. So, Mediterranean Sea, Sea of Galilee. Then you've got the Jordan River. The river began on the lower slopes of Mount Hermon, descends about 2,300 feet in about 100 miles, not counting all the meanders of the river, but just the as the crow flies, if you like, southward from Hermon, and it flows through the Sea of Galilee and then on down to the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea, also called by the Romans Lake Asphaltitis, its surface is the lowest point on Earth, 1,296 feet below sea level, probably lower than that now because they've been using up a lot of the water for irrigation, and that has lowered the Sea of Galilee, but that was typically the kind of depth, elevation in antiquity and up until the big irrigation projects started in the last 30 years. The water's extremely salty. Fish can't live in it. People find it irritates their skin, but if you go swimming in it, which a number of people do, you float in it like a cork, and that is a rather unusual phenomenon, if you like. Its waters and the salt deposits were mined back in antiquity and today for various sorts of minerals, particularly salts of one sort or another. So a quick tour, then, of the major bodies of water around Palestine. All of these things we've talked about, the north-south regions and these little individual peculiar regions and the major bodies of water, they're all the same as they were in antiquity. I've left out perhaps one item, a very small lake north of the Sea of Galilee, Lake Merom, which I think still existed in some of the maps I remember seeing from the late 40s, but went in the after Israel began, after the Jews began to resettle land because it was good land that could be used agriculturally, and so is now farmland rather than water. Political features of Palestine, however, have changed drastically since New Testament times, And we're not going to deal with the changes that have taken place nor what's there today, but basically look at the political features back at New Testament times. So this would be more helpful in understanding the Gospels. So we're going to start with political divisions at the time in the ministry of Christ. We start, first of all, with Judea, and that's the territory that runs, well, at various times it's run all the way from the Mediterranean, but by this time it's back in a little bit from the coast and runs up and over the central ridge, the central hill country, around north and south of Jerusalem, basically. That was the old territory, the tribe of Judah. At this particular time, it had been expanded to include Samaria on the north, which still was known by that name, and Idumea on the south, which was also known by that name, but as kind of an administrative unit, often called Judea, Judea, which is obviously a modification of Judah. It was part of the territory that was ruled by Herod the Great during his reign, and I've here got that in my notes as 37 to 4 BC. There's some argument about the end point on that, but we'll not do anything with it here. And this was also then ruled when Augustus verified and modified Herod's will by Herod's son Archelaus from, let's say, 4 BC to about AD 6, and then ruled by the Roman procurators from 6 to 41, and then by Herod's grandson, Herod Agrippa I, from 41 to 44, and then back by the Roman procurators again from 44 to 66. The population of this Judea proper was mostly Jews, but Samaria mostly Gentiles, including some Samaritans, but lots of others, and the Idumea mostly descendants of the Edomites, who, however, had converted Judaism during the Maccabean period, and don't know to what extent how serious they were about that. North of Judea was Galilee, but this was the area west of the Sea of Galilee. This had once been the domain of the some of the northern tribes of Israel, and then after the Assyrians carried off the northern kingdom, and such, it was for a long time the home of Gentiles until the Maccabees became dominant, 160 to, say, 63, and they repopulated it with Jews. It may well be that Mary and Joseph wound up in Nazareth as a result of their ancestors having moved back up in that area. We don't know really much about that. After the death of Herod the Great, when his territory was split up under his will, this was ruled by Herod Antipas, and he shows up in the Gospel accounts from, we think, 4 BC to AD 39, and then it's ruled by the Roman procurators from 39 to 41, not very long, and then by Herod Agrippa, 41 to 44, and then by the Roman procurators again. Some considered Galilee a hotbed of revolutionaries, and it certainly had some up there. Herod had some trouble with that, and the Romans certainly later in the first century, leading up to the Jewish revolt, had troubles with revolutionaries in that area. A narrow strip east of the Jordan River was called Perea, presumably from the Greek pariah, crossed, and was inhabited mainly by Jews by New Testament times. And I think basically the situation was rather like that of Galilee. It had been largely Gentile from the Babylonian captivity down to the Maccabees, and then had been repopulated. It had the same rulers as Galilee. So when Herod the Great was in control of things, this was part of his territory. And then when his territory was split up, this went to Herod Antipas. And when Antipas and Herod Agrippa I were not ruling it, then the Roman procurators were ruling it. There's another territory that had some Herodian rule, and that's typically called today the Tetrarchy of Philip, or Iturea and Trachonitis is another name that's given. It was a multi-ethnic region northeast of the Sea of Galilee and had mostly Gentile inhabitants. After the death of Herod the Great, because he had ruled over that, it was ruled by another one of his sons, Philip, from, let's say again, 4 BC to 34 AD, and then by Roman procurators and Herod Agrippa, as we've mentioned already before. So some of Jesus' ministry takes place in that territory as well, probably the feeding of the 4,000 and some miracles as well. A fifth region we should mention is a region called the Decapolis, Latin Greek for 10 cities, but it wasn't just 10 cities. The whole administrative operation of those areas, and probably very commonly in the ancient Near East, was that a city dominated territory around it. The Decapolis cities were a league of usually 10 Hellenistic cities. The number of cities in there actually went up and down some, and their city territories. And we now have some evidence that the territory of several of these cities included a piece of coast of the Sea of Galilee, so presumably they shared fishing rights and had their own piers and perhaps their own fishing fleets on the Sea of Galilee. The Decapolis would be mostly Gentile inhabitants, though, again, it's most likely, since they're Hellenistic cities, there were some Jewish people there as well. After the Romans came, after the Maccabean period ended, this was made independent of Jewish control. So was never under the control of Herod the Great or of his descendants. So a quick tour then of the territories, political territories, if you like, around the time of Jesus. We might mention a few of the cities of Palestine during the first century AD. There was, of course, Jerusalem. Jerusalem located right up on the ridge in the hill country, so that not going too far west, you could look down and, I guess, see off in the distance where the Mediterranean would be. It wouldn't be very obvious. And going over east of Jerusalem, you could look down and you could actually see the Dead Sea, and you could certainly see the wilderness to the east. that was the Jewish, what we might think of as religious capital of Judea and Palestine. Herod certainly would have his palace there, but not his only palace there. Perhaps was not excited about being that area in the winter. You're up getting towards 3,000 feet, so he had some winter palace stuff down at Jericho, which was much nicer weather, and even down at Masada. We'll say something about Herod's fortifications here in a bit. The Romans did not consider this their capital of Judea while they were in control of the east. Herod himself had built a port city to the northwest of Jerusalem on the Mediterranean coast, and because Palestine did not have any natural harbors, you have a little sort of something where Carmel sticks out, but even that's not very satisfactory. Herod has spent a great deal of money to build an artificial harbor, put huge stones in the water, use cement. Cement is as far back as we know, it's a Roman invention that might conceivably have gotten it from somebody else. And they had even figured out how to make cement that would dry underwater, which we have varieties of that will do that as well. So they had made sort of large jetties that would run out and made an area of calm water that you could bring ships into. And then they could ride out storms in there and not be mashed and such. So that became an important port during Herod the Great's control. And then after his death, the Romans kind of took this as a capital. So when their procurators, when their prefects, whatever, were ruling over Judea. They operated this as the capital. It was a city in which there were both Jews and Gentiles, and in fact the outbreak of the Jewish revolt against Rome spins out of a riot, probably is the right term to say, a confrontation between the Jews and Gentiles of Caesarea. So Herod had palace there. The Roman procurators had a palace there. A inscription mentioning Pontius Pilate was found there, was probably a part of the theater at Caesarea as well. A rather important city in Old Testament times was the city of Samaria that became the capital of the northern kingdom, and that had had its ups and downs, but Herod the Great rebuilt that during his reign, and he named it Sebasta, which is Greek for Augustus, essentially. And Caesarea, named for Caesar, which is kind of becomes the whole family name eventually, but only Julius and Augustus at the time that Herod was around. And Sebasta then named even more explicitly for Augustus. Why he chose the Greek for it instead of the Latin Augustus, I don't know. And that was rebuilt for his army veterans, for Herod's army veterans. And the inhabitants of that were mostly Gentile. A third city in Palestine, Tiberias, named for another emperor. So you've got Julius, who made a shot at emperor and got killed, Augustus, who succeeded, and then his adopted son, I think a nephew or something, Tiberius. This city was built by Herod Antipas when he was made heir of the territory Galilee and Perea, and so he built it on the shore of the Sea of Galilee and named it in honor of Tiberius. The spelling is for the emperor I-U-S at the end and for the city I-A-S of Tiberius. That is actually pretty near where Jesus' ministry takes place, and yet there, as far as I know, there are no explicit references to him being in the city at any time. Besides Antipas, you remember one of the other heirs was Philip, and Philip got the area northeast of the Sea of Galilee here northeast, and so he built a city, and he called it Caesarea again, purposes of not confusing it with other Caesareas. Some people in antiquity called it Caesarea Philippi, Philip's Caesarea, and that has stuck then for use in modern times. So to distinguish the two Caesareas, if it's nothing said, it's the earlier Caesarea that Herod built, or that's sometimes called Caesarea Maritima, a Caesarea on the sea, and the other one, Caesarea Philippi. It was built as a capital then for Herod's Herod Philip's tetrarchy, so up in that territory and up pretty close to the headwaters of the Jordan River there. There are a number of decapolis cities, more than 10 at some times and less than 10 at other times. I just gave for my students 5 of them here, which show up now and then either in the New Testament or in Josephus' writing, Scythopolis, the city of the Scythians, so something about its history back several centuries. Hippos, named for horse, okay? Not sure what the exact reason for that is. Gadara, one of the alternative names that should come up in the Gadarene demoniacs things. Well, that's one of the passages we'll look at here later, so we'll say something about that. And Gerasa, one of the other names that show up for that. And then Philadelphia, name for Ptolemy Philadelphus, probably. City of Brotherly Love, as those of you who live in the East or live in Philadelphia area know it from Pennsylvania here. So those would be some of the Decapolis cities. Galilean towns, probably city would be pushing it a little bit. These are not at least fortified cities. Nazareth, where Jesus comes from, not named explicitly in the Old Testament, though there are these Netzer passages that we mentioned in connection with Messianic prophecy. Cana, Magdala, Capernaum, Chorazin, Bethsaida. Magdala, Capernaum, Chorazin, Bethsaida, all basically on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and Cana and Nazareth back up in sort of the hill country of Galilee. Some Judean towns, besides Jerusalem. Jericho, certainly important in Old Testament times, and still important at New Testament times. There was an Old and a New Jericho, probably that's part of the explanation for how Jesus heals this particular blind man coming to one Jericho. You know, so coming to Jericho in Luke and leaving Jericho in Matthew and Mark. New Jericho was a snazzy place, and well-to-do people lived there, and that's probably where the tax collector Zacchaeus lived. And the other one was the more traditional city, and probably what Matthew at least perhaps would have thought of in terms of a Judean city. Bethany, across the Mount of Olives from Jerusalem. Bethlehem, south of Jerusalem, going out, actually heading out a little bit almost into the wilderness. And then Emmaus, there's some uncertainty on where the two are going to Emmaus, which of a couple of different locations that is, but the general agreement, it's northwest of Bethlehem. So, cities of Palestine during the first century A.D., Jerusalem, the Jewish, what should we say, religious capital, Caesarea, the Roman capital, Sebaste, the Old Testament Samaria rebuilt for Herod's veterans, Tiberias, the capital of Galilee, Caesarea Philippi, the capital of the Tetrarchy of Philip, these Decapolis cities, Galilean towns, and Judean towns. A word or two about some major roads. To the best of my knowledge, we do not have names for these roads that come from New Testament times. So the names I'm going to use here for the three roads we're going to discuss are traditional names that are used in biblical studies, and some of these certainly come from earlier periods in the history of the region. The first of these, the name actually comes from a passage in Isaiah, I think it is, Via Maris, the way of the sea, which is a nice descriptive term. It was a coastal highway that came up not quite at the coast, but parallel the coast and a few miles inland from Egypt, and then just south of the Carmel Ridge, it split, and one piece went up to the west and stayed on the coast and went on up then to Tyre, Sidon, etc., to Antioch eventually, up that direction, and the other one turned east at that point. Went through, I think, the Megiddo Pass, and comes down to the Sea of Galilee, goes by Tiberias, and then goes on up and heads out to Damascus. So, a major north-south coastal road, and certainly carried a good bit of trade traffic that did not go, say, by sea. Certainly a lot of trade traffic would have run up the coast and come in at a port or something, and then perhaps been transshipped over. The second road I want to say a word or two about is kind of parallels this, but it's back across the Rift Valley and up on the Transjordan Plateau, and that had the name the King's Highway, and that goes back to who knows what king, but runs on the Transjordan Plateau and runs from the Gulf of Aqaba at the top of the, I guess we'd call it the Red Sea, and so goods shipped in from the south came up to the port there, and then went overland up the King's Highway, and that went by some of the Decapolis cities and then angled over to Damascus as well. And both of those, the Via Maris and the King's Highway from Damascus, connected into roads that went up into the Mesopotamian Valley. The cities over there, Palmyra and such, then over to the west, over to the east, excuse me. A third road probably rather more used by the Jews in connection with their travel back and forth from Galilee to Jerusalem, is the road that stayed along the ridge of the hill country, and so has the name that we use, Ridge Route. It was less important for international traffic because it was not as easy to travel along. It went up and down, and perhaps not as well paved, we might say, but was rather important, as I say, for pilgrims going from Jerusalem to Galilee, with one serious drawback, and that's it went through Samaria. So people going from the Jerusalem back home to Galilee or vice versa, coming down for festivals, might use it, but if they were edgy about the Samaritans or not in too much hurry, they might instead go down and go down into the Rift Valley and use a road there and then come back up again. And so we see both of those kinds of routes used in connection with people going to and from Jerusalem. So a quick tour of the three major roads. There were obviously a lot more roads. There were roads, obviously, that connected, from the Via Maris over to Jerusalem, and from Jerusalem over and down through across the Jordan and back up to the King's Highway. And there would be something similar to that at a couple of other places along the way. Lastly, under our discussion of geography of Palestine, is the Herodian fortifications. One of the reasons Herod is called Herod the Great is not because of his great personality, but because of his great building activities. And major structures around the Temple of Jerusalem are his. The major structures in Sebaste, in Caesarea, are his. major structure at Hebron is his, okay? The patriarchal temple burial there of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc., are all Herod's. And he also built some fortifications. He was well aware that, one, he was not super popular with the Jews, but two, that the Roman Empire ended not too many miles to the east of him, and that there was a pretty strong nation, the Parthians, to the east there. And right at the beginning of his career, well, not quite the beginning, right before he became king of the Jews, the Parthians had invaded and had killed his, had captured and imprisoned his older brother. I think his Phasael was his older brother now. Slips my mind now. But Phasael committed suicide to avoid, I suppose, being tortured or something of that sort. Herod had gotten away, so Herod always has that in mind. And then somewhat later in his career, after he was king of the Jews but didn't feel terribly safe yet, there were still Cleopatra and Antony to worry about. And then even after all that was over, there were still possible rebellions to worry about. So he built himself a number of fortifications. He built himself a fortification at Machaerus, east of the Dead Sea. And this is a location where, according to Josephus, John the Baptist was put to death. John the Baptist was beheaded, presumably over there. The New Testament does not tell us where that took place. But that was in the territory of Herod Antipas, who was the Herod that put John to death. You remember, Herod the Great is gone by then. He had put the little babies to death in trying to get Jesus, but Herod Antipas had put John the Baptist to death. Then there was Masada on the west side of the Dead Sea, and Masada, I guess both Machaerus and Masada were not only fortifications, but they were palaces for Herod. So he wanted somewhere where he could retreat to and not have to give up at least all of his royal prerogatives while he was laying low till the whatever revolt or whatever blew over on the west of the Dead Sea. And that has been pretty extensively excavated and has two palaces on it. One kind of up on top. It's a mesa, I guess, in southwestern American English. So a plateau with rather steep sides, the Dead Sea off to one side and various wadis coming down to the Dead Sea on the west side. And so he'd built a western palace on top, and then on the north end, down, kind of working its way down the slope, so that it got some shade. There was his North Palace, and some rather elaborate stuff still surviving there in recent excavations. So this was his palace, and then after he died, it fell into the hands of the Zealots during the Jewish revolt, and this was, in fact, the place that they made their last stand against the Romans. The Romans had conquered Jerusalem in 70, but it wasn't until 73 that they felt they were ready to go and surround Masada and smoke them out, so to speak. And, in fact, the Zealots at Masada committed suicide rather than give up there. A third fortification of Herod is one called Herodium. So Herod modestly named it for himself. Here he took a hill southeast of Bethlehem and built up the top of it, so it actually looks a little like a volcano today, and put a palace in there. That was his retreat palace, and then down at the base of the hill he had a palace that he could use for, what shall we say, less dangerous situations. For many, many years, well, since Josephus, it's been understood that Herod's tomb was there, and I believe the evidence for that has been recently discovered, though I haven't heard how that's all settled out. No body of Herod or anything of that sort has been found there, but some structures that look like they might well be Herod's tomb have recently been found. Well, that's our tour of the geography of Israel, Palestine, if you like. We want to say a few words about the geography of Jerusalem. Some more detail on that. Here, we're going to divide our stuff up again into, first of all, what we might call the natural features, the valleys around Jerusalem and the hills around Jerusalem, and then look into the city walls, which we can still find some fairly good traces of some of them anyway, and then the various sections of the city, and then a few of the particular major buildings and structures and things that were there at Jesus' time. So, Jerusalem, up basically on the ridge of the hill country, surrounded by some valleys. Jerusalem was pretty easy to fortify in three directions, and not so easy on the north side. We have a valley running down the west side of Jerusalem and then across the bottom that's called the Hinnom Valley. This is a pretty deep valley, and became at one point a place where garbage was burned. And so the Hebrew Gay Hinnom, Valley of Hinnom, became a picture in Jewish thought of hell. So Gehenna, the term you will see in the New Testament now and again, unless your translation translates it away in some way, is this particular term. To the east of Jerusalem, there was another fairly deep valley called the Kidron Valley, and it's between the Temple and the Mount of Olives. So when Jesus does his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, he comes down the Mount of Olives and then back up to come into the probably the east gate of the temple complex. And so Kidron Valley would be the location at Gethsemane, though there's a couple of different suggestions for just where the Garden of Gethsemane was. There's a third valley, which is not nearly as noticeable today. Aerial photos taken near sunset, you get some hints of it. It was the valley in Josephus is called Tyropian, Cheesemaker's Valley. I'm not sure exactly what the Hebrew of it might have been, and I don't know that we've got a document that tells us that. It was between the Temple Mount on the east side of the city and the territory south of that where David had originally conquered Jerusalem and such, and the western part of Jerusalem where the upper city was and such. This valley is now pretty largely filled in, but there are some light traces of it. So those are the valleys around Jerusalem. Jerusalem is also surrounded by hills. It's in hill country, and it's a hill country with lots of valleys and such. So a few of the important hills around Jerusalem. David, you remember, conquered the city from the Jebusites, and the Jebusite city had actually been a rather small city on a hill that is south of where the temple is now, and that was called the city of the Jebusites, and was also called Ophel. And again, I don't know for sure what the history of that name is. So the area south of the temple, but still up on this hill between the Kidron Valley to the east and the Tarapean Valley to the west, is Ophel. The hill on which the temple came to be built is Moriah, site of the temple, and apparently the site of Abraham's almost sacrifice of Isaac. Not quite as much certainty there, but some hints in that direction from the biblical material. There's the term Zion that also occurs in connection with Jerusalem, and that was probably originally either Ophel or Moriah, and comes to be kind of a generic term for the whole city. But then in medieval times, that comes to be applied to the western hill, the upper city, if you like. So if you talk about going to Mount Zion now, if you tell a taxi driver you want to go to Mount Zion, he's going to put you over there rather than at the Ophel or the temple site, if you like. A third hill is the Mount of Olives, outside the city, perhaps to the ridge about a half mile east from the city. It was at the edge of the wilderness, so up on the top of Mount of Olives you can look out and see the wilderness to the west of you, to the east of you, and the much more vegetated area to the west of you. it was on the way from Jericho to Jerusalem, so the road would come over the Mount of Olives there, site of Jesus' ascension. The hill of the upper city is west of the Ophel across the Cheesemaker's Valley and higher than Ophel or Moriah. So if you stand on the Mount of Olives and take a picture looking west across the city, you can see this territory standing higher there. As I say, that was called Zion in the Middle Ages, but probably misidentified. So that's the hills and the valleys around Jerusalem. The next thing we might mention here is the city walls at the New Testament times. And some of these walls still stand or have walls built on the same general lines, same foundations as they do. And the walls roughly follow these valleys on the, you know, so as to make it, when a person attacks a city, they got to go down the valley and then up to the wall, and rather difficult to get into the place. So the south wall is generally taken to run around the where the Kidron and the Kidron and the Hinnom Valley run together, and so it kind of encloses the Tarapean Valley and the city. So that's the south wall around this way, with the Hinnom Valley over here and the Kidron coming down here. The east wall on the get the Kidron Valley over here on the east side of the city. Here's the city, Kidron Valley here, and the east wall is up the slopes of the Kidron Valley and along the east side of the temple. The west wall on the Hinnom Valley, but on the east side of it, that is on the city side of the Hinnom Valley. And so those walls go back, I think, probably as far back as the bigger city has existed, so probably from shortly after Solomon's time or something of that, though doubtless they've been rebuilt on several occasions. The north side of the city, though, didn't really have any good valley protecting it, and so over the history they have built several walls going out further as the city has expanded. The first north wall basically ran from the temple up north a little bit, and then swung back around and came back over and met the Hinnom Valley, down near what we call the Joppa Gate, I guess. The second north wall then was apparently built after the, I got that not looking at my map properly. The first north wall just basically ran east from the Joppa Gate right over to the temple. The second north wall ran out from there and then went north and then came back around and came back to the temple. So it enclosed a little bit bigger area on the north side of the city. And then the third north wall was not there at Jesus' time. So the territory that it enclosed was suburb, I guess you would use the term there, though it doesn't have the same flavor it did in does today. It began after Jesus' ministry, begun by Herod Agrippa, and then when the Roman emperor said, cut that out, he stopped, and it was finished during the revolt then in 66 to 70 A.D. It ran north from the east side of the temple up the Kidron Valley for a ways and then swung around and came back down to the Joppa Gate. So three north walls. These sets of walls then divided the city into sections. Down here south of the temple is the old city of David, the territory he conquered, the old Jebusite city, and it's basically on Ophel Hill. Then there's the Temple Mount north of that, and that was built by Solomon, and it's on Mount Moriah. Then there's the lower city, and there's some disagreement by map makers on just where to put that, but I go along with what appears to be the majority of them, and that is the Tyropian Valley, so west of Ophel, and before you get up onto the upper western part of the city, the upper city, the lower city. Upper city, this hill that runs, here's the Tyropian Valley, it's over here to the west of it, and then the Hinnom Valley is over here, so it's up in that particular region, the upper city. There are a couple other pieces to the city. There's the territory called the Second Quarter, which is between the first and second city walls, and then finally what was called New City or Bezetha, which was between the second and third wall. So these would both be extensions out to the north of the city. some major buildings and structures from the New Testament period. We have, first of all, the temple complex. The temple we generally think of as the building, but there was also a large platform it was built on. When Herod the Great, at least, thought in terms of refurbishing the temple about 20 B.C., he realized that because the land fell off like it did around the around that hill, Moriah, it would be necessary to build what he wanted to extend that. And so he took what was perhaps initially a 500-cubit square, probably left over from Solomon's temple, but at least standing at the second temple, and extended that some significant difference distance to the south. And then we get a kind of longer rectangle. And at the outer edge of this platform, if you like, or a terrace, if you like, you've actually got a pretty long drop-off to the bottom of the Tyropian Valley on one side and the Kidron Valley to the other side. on top of this platform, then, the temple stood in the, not exact middle, but roughly middle, and there was a open porchway with a roof on it around three sides, two sides anyway. The south side was called the Royal Portico, and the east side, Solomon's Portico. Solomon's Portico indicates, I think, that probably Solomon had something there in the original temple, though the material we've got now is later than that. And the Royal Portico, probably built by Herod, but the name suggests that the followers did not want to advertise Herod or something of that sort. In any case, that's the temple building. So a platform with the courts, the outer court of the Gentiles, and then the main court being the court of the women, And then inside that, you come up a stairway, and there's a very narrow court of the men where they could stand and put their hands on the animals as they were sacrificed. And then the bigger court of the priests. And then back in that, the court, temple complex itself. The platform was probably about 750 feet east-west, that is about 500 cubits, and about twice that north-south. So Herod had substantially increased the size of the temple platform from what we get as the traditional size that shows up in rabbinic literature. Just north and west of the temple, and actually adjoining it, is the Fortress Antonia, and that rebuilt at least by Herod. And by New Testament times, that was being used as the place where the Roman garrison kept an eye on things, because temple festivals sometimes developed into riots of one sort or another due to dissatisfaction, perhaps with of some of the worshippers with the Romans or something of that sort. The Romans wanted to be right there to be able to do anything. Traditionally, the Fortress Antonia is the site of Jesus' Roman trial, though a number of people now think perhaps it was over at Herod's palace, which we'll say a word about here in a moment. The West Gate, out of the city of Jerusalem, and where a road then ran off to Jaffa, or Joppa, was called the Jaffa Gate, and there were three big towers for defensive purposes built there. At that gate, one was named for Herod's brother Phasael, who had died in the Parthian invasion. One was named for Herod's, what should we say, favorite wife, Mariamne, who, in spite of which, he put to death. And one named for a friend of his, Hippicus. So, Jaffa Gate Towers. One of those towers, the lower parts are still surviving, and you can actually visit and view that. When you're at Jerusalem. Just south of the Jaffa Gate Towers is Herod's palace, built by Herod the Great, so obviously with Herod off the scene. This is probably used by the Roman governor when he was in the city, rather than by Herod Antipas, who after all didn't have quite the, what should we say, political standing that the Roman governor had. And that's the alternate site for the Roman trial, so if Pilate was down here, then that's where it was, because we're told Pilate came out and went back in, etc. Or if it was being used for some other reason at the festival, for instance, Pilate might have felt safer in the Antonia fortress than would be the Antonia. Whatever, those are the two candidates for that. There was a Sanhedrin building, and we think it was near the temple and on the platform somewhere, but we do not now know where it was. The rabbinic literature calls it the Hall of Hewn Stones, and this is probably the site of Jesus' condemnation on Friday morning before they take him to try and get Pilate to validate their sentence. The model of Jerusalem at the Holy Land Hotel also attempts to place a chariot racing stadium called Hippodrome in Greek, horse run, okay? and if you've ever seen the film Ben-Hur, they have a very authentic-looking hippodrome, long straightaways with sharp turns on either end. So instead of being a nice big oval, as, say, horse racing places are in Western culture, they're a long straightaway and then a sharp turn and a long straightaway, etc. And I refer you to Ben-Hur for that particular thing. The location is uncertain, but some put it in the Tyropean Valley. That's where this particular model puts it. Josephus also tells us there was a theater in Jerusalem, so both those features would have been much more Hellenistic. They certainly weren't traditional Jewish sorts of things, and the location of that is uncertain. Most of us, when we think of a theater, either think of a movie theater, or perhaps we think of something like Shakespeare's Globe Theater or something of that sort. The Greek and Roman theaters, particularly the Greek theaters, were a kind of a half circle, often cut into the side of a hill, and with
stone, I guess, though they may well have used concrete as well, bleachers, we would say, around, going up higher and higher with various aisles running down along them. So that actual model has been used even into the 20th century for theaters and various kinds of stadiums as well. That would probably have been used to perform plays of one sort or another. We're told by some of your Jewish writers that some of the Hellenistic Jews had in fact constructed plays about Ezekiel and that sort of thing, so that there were some what we might think of as religious plays rather than just the pagan Greek plays and the very lewd Roman plays around. Some other sites related to Jesus' ministry, the Pool of Bethesda. You remember in John 5 that Jesus finds a lame person at the Pool of Bethesda, and the tradition is at least that he was waiting for the moving of the water, etc. And I don't think the best text of John 5 supports the tradition, but appears that at least somebody, perhaps a marginal note or something, had entered a note about that. And certainly the narrative of John 5 indicates that that the lame guy had some such thing in mind. And we're told of this a pool that had five porticos. Portico, the term for these covered porches, usually with columns on either side to hold up the roof. And lo and behold, just north of the temple and northeast of the Antonia Fortress, they have found, buried pretty deeply at this point with the rubble over the centuries, but now dug out, a pool that had four porchways around the outside and one across the middle, dividing it into two pools. And so the general belief is that is the Pool of Bethesda, where this particular place that Jesus healed the lame man took place. There's another pool in the mystery, Jesus, and that's the Pool of Siloam, where Jesus sent the fellow who's blind. You remember he made clay and put it on the blind man's eyes. And the Pool of Siloam has been known for a long, long time on where it is. It's south of the temple, kind of south, slightly west of the temple in the Tyropean Valley, right down where the near the south end of the city where the Tyropean and Hinnom come together. And that has been excavated also and is narrated for us in John 9. Some other places, the Upper Room, where the Last Supper was held. Well, there's a traditional site of the Upper Room, and it's a second floor, but the problem is, from Josephus' descriptions, there does not appear to have been any second floors left after the Romans were finished with Jerusalem in 70 AD. So it might be near the site. Hard to say, but that's the traditional one. If you're in Jerusalem as a tourist, they'll take you to that. The architecture there is what I would call, as a non-architect, Gothic or something like that. So it's a Crusader period, clearly. Caiaphas' house, a place where Jesus was taken for perhaps a preliminary hearing of some sort, possibly with a part or maybe even all of Sanhedrin there. That's traditionally in the upper city, and a site is shown for that, even a little cave where Jesus is claimed to have been held as a prisoner overnight. I don't know what to say about that. It was a shrine of some sort of Christians a few centuries later, but whether they've got the right site is somewhat hard to be sure of. Gethsemane, we know, is an olive grove in the Kidron Valley on the slopes of the Mount of Olives. There are several sites claimed by various religious groups. That brings us last of all to Calvary or Golgotha. There are three sites I'm aware of now claimed, up from two when I first taught this course. the traditional one is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and that may very well be authentic, but it certainly doesn't look very authentic anymore. It's had a church built over it for probably 1,500 years at least, and is the most widely recognized and has been recognized since the time of Constantine. And they show you a place where Calvary was and a place where the tomb was and that sort of thing. And for at least Western Christians, it looks way too ornate and such, kind of turns you off. There's Gordon's Calvary, a site that I guess that was the General Charles Gordon suggested that probably looks more like what Calvary looked like in Jesus' time, but the evidence is rather strong against historicity. The tomb there is not a new tomb, which is what the Gospels tell us the tomb of Joseph Arimathea was, but this tomb appears to go back to Iron Age period, so several centuries old by New Testament times. Ernest Martin, who has done a number of things in suggesting a date for the birth of Christ that's fairly close to the traditional date, but not very close to the date that's been used the last few centuries of 4 or 5 B.C., but he goes with like 1 B.C., 2 B.C., actually, has also suggested a site for the Mount of Olives. He basically claims that somehow the centurion standing on the Mount of on the Mount Calvary was able to see the curtain ripped in half. As I read the text over, it doesn't look like that's necessary to the text, though perhaps you could read it that way. And so he puts it east of Jerusalem, so in the direction where the temple actually faced, and puts it on the Mount of Olives. He puts it near the site of the slaughtering of the red heifer, citing so typological reasons as well as historical reasons. So that's his suggestion. Well, that's a quick tour. There's lots and lots more that can be said, and I hear that Ted has got some good stuff up on the geography and archaeology and such of Jerusalem and Palestine, so I refer you to those here. But this is what I have in my Synoptic Gospels course. Thank you very much for your attention.